Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown. Brian, to me, was sort of the classic definition of a raconteur. Whenever you talk to Brian, you would always have a great story from the time he ran away with a copy of Jack Kerouac's On the Road tucked under his arm heading out to the West Coast, or when he met JFK doing this, or met with Khrushchev doing that, or whatever. I mean, he's a great guy and a really a role model for us all. You're listening to The Brown Briefly, where we live in hope of a peaceful transition of government, something I thought I would never say about the United States of America. Is Tuesday, the 8th of December, in the hopefully last year of the tweet, 2020.
Oh, sorry, I don't have the tweet.
Oops, that's okay.
We can get used to not hearing it.
Yes. Where is Michael when we need him, right?
Well, actually, let's enjoy the silence of it, you know? I mean, there you go.
That's right. With us live in the Gene Bosch studio in bustling downtown Vachon is our mood-modulating sound engineer and techno-wizard, Truman O'Brien.
Good morning.
Pilot extraordinaire, horse whisperer, grill master, and translator of Vachon veterans' buddies who are Trump supporters. What do you hear from your buddies about the election, Truman?
You know, it's been real quiet. Every once in a while, somebody will comment, you know, that fat lady hadn't sung, you know, or something along those lines. But I think mostly they're kind of going to take it in stride, that it is what it is, you know, doggone it. They're disappointed, but that's the way it is. So
thank goodness they're disappointed, right?
Yeah.
From the comfort of their Zoom lairs spread around Vachon Island is our indefatigable team of commentators. Our heavy lifting champion of democratic values, indivisible Vachon's intrepid Kevin Jones. What's up this week with indivisible Vachon?
Hey, the very visible indivisible Vachon, we hope. We have some activities going on this week. At noon tomorrow, actually, is our immigration refugee work group, and it runs for about an hour and a half, and at the Sheffield building, if you're interested in dropping by. But best if you, as a dear listener, would email me at kevin@indivisiblevachon.org. And if folks want to also participate, we are looking ahead to 2021 at next Wednesday. It happens to be our monthly Indivisible Vachon meeting, very, very Zoomish. That starts at 7. And oh, by the way, the immigration refugee meeting is not happening in person. It's also Zoomish. So if you want to join either one of those, kevin@indivisiblevachon.org, and we'll make sure you get connected.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Also with us is futurist, writer, dreamcatcher, peripatetic poet, Gail Kellner, and her, what kind of dog do you have?
It's a little spaniel puppy.
Spaniel puppy, beautiful little brown and white spaniel puppy. Gail, do you have some words of wisdom for us?
Well, you know, I looked, this week was a tough one for me, parts of it, and I found myself wandering out into the trails of Vachon and re-exploring some old ones and finding some new ones. Judd Creek Trail. So my words of wisdom is get outside when you are feeling fatigued because of the holidays or the pandemic or the politics. What a relief it was to walk that trail and the Shingle Mill Creek Trail, which I noted had been expanded. And as me and my little pup discovered, there's now an access from the back of the Vashon Community Care Center that is all age friendly. And I thought to myself, what a gift to our community that is. So kudos to those responsible for that. I believe the Land Trust and others. And with that note, I have a very short poem from Wendell Berry, who does have words of wisdom. He wrote, many of you know this poem, and I can never hear it too many times, The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake, with the wood drake, where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free.
Beautiful. Thank you, Gail. Also with us is plain-spoken Brooklyn Dodger fan. There's not many of those left. Actor, singer, gardener, half a bubble shy of plum carpenter, Michael Shook. Michael, what are the plants telling you today?
They're telling me that it ain't over until it's over. And I'm not talking about the election. I'm talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers. Someday, even though they've been in Los Angeles for longer than they were in Brooklyn.
The great diaspora of the Brooklyn Dodgers may come to an end at some point. Return to the homeland, right?
That's it. A friend of ours who happens to be Jewish said there's an old saying that they often use, next year, Jerusalem.
Dodger Stadium, right?
That's silly. They are where they are, and it's wonderful. And hopefully baseball will return, as some other things we hope, to some semblance of normalcy. And that's essentially what the plant's been telling me, what Wendell Berry spoke about in that wonderful poem, Gail. Thanks for sharing that. The world goes on. The robins come out when the rain stops and look for food, and the pileated woodpeckers are hurling themselves around like crazy beasts, and you know, the deer are out browsing, and so it's everything's growing, you know, the moss and the ferns. Spring will be here before we know it. So
I can hardly wait. Right.
There you go. Especially you, poor Bruce. You're stuck here for the winter instead of being down under.
Wah, 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 right? With us also is that rare feminist who grew up in the deep South before escaping to the far Pacific Northwest, academic artist and provocateur Lynn Kerrigan. Lynn, what have you been provocateuring about recently?
Hey, good morning. I have been doing more of what Gail is talking about. For me, it's a provocateur day if I'm taking care of myself, as opposed to riding herd on the world and trying to make sure it stays in ship shape. You know, I'm one of your minions in the Guardians of the Galaxy. So I've been doing a lot of sitting outside, and I fired up my chimnea this week, which was really fun. I inherited that from my daughter, and it fits just perfectly, tucked inside the front of my house with a few lawn chairs around it. And I've had, I'm ashamed to say, three separate times, maybe four now in the last week, where I fired it up in the late afternoon and various neighbors have come over to sit there and enjoy the twilight and the sunset and sitting around a fire and staring at those embers instead of a TV set or even the radio. You know, it's been a wonderful balm for my soul just to be outside as much as I can. So I'm with y'all.
Great. Well, and I'm your host today, Bruce Hallman. A year ago, over a year ago, Brian Brown, who died this last January, asked a very interesting question. He said, if you travel the upper reaches of Vashon Highway beyond the roastery, but before the country store, you may have noticed a singularly impressive road sign created by water jet and stainless steel artist Bob Powell, which reads, objective reality exists. So my question to the Briefleys, is there an objective reality? Are we doomed to fight another civil war to decide the issues that are in front of us right now?
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would say, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity would tell us that absolutely there is no such thing as objective reality. That's the very basis of that idea of relativity. However, I think that's more at a level that is not related so much to our day-to-day lives. And I think it's so important that we do come to agree upon an objective reality, certainly in the political world and in the understanding of the pain and suffering that is happening around the world, of the need to work together, of our responsibility to one another. And so I personally do believe that there is objective reality in the world we occupy.
Yeah, Lynn.
You know, Gail, I appreciate physics a lot, and I am always stunned at the day-to-day practical applicability of it. And I think what I feel a lot about is more Schrodinger's cat, you know, that weird physics conundrum that a cat that you can't see in a box could either be dead or alive at the same time. I'm very fascinated by that because it seems that's where we are to me. We live with the possibility of either being true and both being true, that we can come to some kind of commonality. I don't know that I'll use the word objectivity, but I like the kind of thinking about how do we find a commonality that we can use to cheer us and rally us and have something, you know, to work toward together. You know, I'd like that cat to be let out of the box alive and kicking and scratching. And I look forward to thinking more about commonalities and kind of how do we get behind each other in our search for something different than we have had.
Well, and one of Schrodinger's points was that essentially when we look in the box and observe the cat, we change, you know, what the situation was. So that idea that we as observers have an influence over what we're observing.
That's right. We're not passive, you know, spectators. This is not television. This is everyday life where we have to dig in and open that box and deal with that scratching cat. That's just where we are.
Kevin?
You know, this reality is a challenging topic. I can tell you that when Bob Ferguson visited Vashon 3 years ago now, I had a chance to speak with him privately after the talk and asked him what he thought the biggest challenge was for us going forward with the administration that we still have for another 40 odd days. And he said the departure from reality and the fact that you don't have a basis for conversation to allow you to make forward progress. A year ago, he gave a presentation and he essentially alluded to the same issue as one of the top issues he's concerned about. So whether it's objective reality, whatever we want to call it, the fact that, that this non-truth frame that we now have to deal with in our society really is, you know, takes us away from the ability to do things. In his world, it's how to adjudicate the laws, and that's very fundamental to our society. So I think it's quite challenging to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Michael?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of objective reality. I love the whole physics thing and string theory as well, and all kinds of crazy things like that, that there might be multiple dimensions that we exist in simultaneously, but the, but I kind of, for me, and this probably comes back to, again, working in the lines of work that I've worked in where things were very concrete, if not literally concrete at times. If you make a mistake at the wrong moment, someone can lose his thumb or have his leg crushed, or it's just that kind of objective reality is what I've dealt with my whole life. And here's another example. I was reading that in the past week, 15,813 people have died from coronavirus.
Yeah, that's objective.
Which staggers me. Yesterday was the 79th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, in which 2,403 sailors and soldiers and a handful of civilians were killed in that attack. That's, we've had the equivalent almost of a Pearl Harbor every day for the last week. So there's objective reality. We can, as an old farmer said to me, it was the first time I ever heard it in my youth when I said something, gee, I sure wish blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, blank in one hand and wish in the other and see which fills up first. It's just kind of, you can't deny the facts.
Kevin?
You know, I have tried to think of ways to articulate the sheer numbers, Michael, that you talk about. And then it's just startling because of the clear of, you know, lack of people paying attention. But, you know, like how many 737 equivalents are we talking about? You know, it's Truman would know. It's probably as many as maybe up to four or five a day now that we're working up to. You know, we hear the news reports. I haven't found one that's not been debunked yet, but I think they may be out there, of patients who are being treated for COVID who in their last gasp says it's not COVID. I don't, you know, we've talked in the past about, you know, new technologies in the way we get our information, like social media, and that any new technology is challenging and has to ultimately be regulated. And what I'm wondering now, this such an intensive avoidance of the truth, is it just that we have a new media type, or is it that we now have online media lies that are so consistently and widely applied? And what is it? Is it new media, or just the fact that we have this post-truth media empire? I'm still scratching my head.
Lynn?
I think both of those are true, Kevin. And Michael, you know, related to what you said, to me, I think some of what's going on is, you know, climate change is real, looking at all the cyclones and all the rainfalls and all the floods and devastation. And I read something, and I wish I could remember the citation of who wrote it, but it was somebody British who was writing about, you know, the difficulties with Brexit also, you know, with Britain trying to leave the EU, which is past its, you know, deadline for doing so, and they're trying to figure out how to write this all up about trade. But it made me think a lot about the U.S. This writer is saying, you know, we're all having a nervous breakdown. The truth is flipping scary. And human nature is not to deal with things that they cannot deal with immediately in front of their face. It drives people mad sometimes. It makes people angry. It makes people hide. You know, but I like that idea that this is not a new reality that we are in the sense of an enduring, and I'm, by this, that, I meant the Trumpism, that what is happening that is real is very scary realities, and that we are having a nervous breakdown, you know, trying to figure out how to wrap our minds around it and trying to quit going after each other instead of rallying for a common defense or a common move against COVID and climate change and racial migrations and all of the other things we're having to deal with that are just frightening. Gail.
Bruce, I wondered if you could weigh in on this. You know, the United States has been united for roughly 250 years. As history goes, that's a fairly long run. And I'm curious, what would it look like to ununite the United States? Maybe not clear to 50 individual states, but maybe some kind of a different configuration. If we truly can't come to an agreed reality, you know, maybe Cascadia, Washington, Oregon, California, being a country, might be Texas alone would like to be the, as they are, they the Lone Star State. They struck out on their own early. Certainly the South has a shared cultural set of values, as does, you know, I'm imagining Bernie and Warren could govern the Northeast. I mean, let alone the vast Midwest that seems to have a shared values, because in many ways, I think what holds a country together is a shared set of values and a shared understanding of the world. And I don't know that we are going to easily put that back together. So what's the chances? I mean, Brexit is an example of Britain stepping out of the European Union. Is it impossible to do it without a civil war? Could we do it through agreement? I mean, Gorbachev certainly undid the Soviet Union in rather swift motion. Mm-hmm.
Lynn?
Well, I was just going to, and she directed her question to you, so I don't want to jump in front of your answer to kind of her about what does it take, but I wanted to emphasize something I was making my point about a nervous breakdown. States, nations can have nervous breakdowns in the sense of it's not necessarily permanent, not necessarily civil war worthy. It's that everybody went into extremism and expressions of anger and fear all at once. And, you know, I was fascinated at Biden's choice to stay quiet during a lot of that. And it did indeed kind of ebb away without many people, without him feeding it, you know, feeding the rage and the fear and all of that. And yet I don't want him to sweep any of the underlying causes under the rug. So Bruce, I'll kick it back to you in the sense of temporary versus so extreme that somebody's going to have to secede and fight each other over it.
And from my perspective, sort of two comments is one, I mean, the attack on objective reality is nothing new. I mean, it's been going on in politics since politics began, you know. Right now it's particularly virulent, and it's particularly virulent in the United States. But if you talk to people in Europe or people in like I do in Australia, New Zealand, or people in other parts of the world, they're not experiencing this sort of angst that Americans are experiencing because their countries have, you know, approached the coronavirus in different ways and have approached, you know, democratic elections in different ways or are not democracies. So I think we're in a particular state, and we tend to sort of hyperventilate over this sort of truth kind of thing that's going on in the United States right now. It's not as prevalent around the world as it is in the United States. And then the second part, Gail, really, I mean, all it takes is a constitutional convention to rewrite the Constitution and to redefine what the United States is. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's, you know, there's going to be a lot of opposition to it, and there's a lot of reasons to do it and a lot of reasons not to do it. But technically, in terms of doing it, you know, if people came to a common agreement, you know, a constitutional convention could rewrite the Constitution, redefine what the United States is, and the United States could become the Southeast and Cascadia and Northeastery and the Midwest could all become separate countries. That's possible. Whether or not we want to go down that path is another question. Truman?
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, I tuned out on the first bit of our conversation today because I had to take care of some stuff here in the studio. But sure. But one of the things that strikes me is that phrase clear and present danger, You know, that's one of the things that the pandemic has not provided us, really. I mean, it's there, but it's kind of all around. It's nebulous. It's not this, you know, two airplanes crashing into a building or Japanese bombing a Pearl Harbor. It's kind of this nebulous thing that we can't all get behind to fight. And I think that the United States works best when they have a clear and present danger. I mean, if there's something that's clearly adversarial to us, we can unite and work toward that end. And the problem with this is that it's not. And I think that's one of the biggest issues of this. Kevin.
Yeah. Let me jump in and just suggest that's because of the way it was handled by the United States.
I agree.
You look at Australia, you look at New Zealand, you look at Italy, you look at Britain, they've handled it very different.
Right.
You look at Taiwan, you look at Japan, because they saw it as a clear and present danger, and they approached it that way. The leadership of the United States, the Trump administration, decided it was all kind of a hoax and it didn't approach it as the crisis that it is. And to me, that's really, that's the legacy of the Trump administration for the next generation. Kevin, you had something, and then Michael.
Well, I was going to, the point that Truman just made has been in my mind as well. And I think about the parallels with climate change. In climate change, we have data. Polling data that says that, you know, most people now believe that climate change is real, it's human caused, and it is creating impacts in people's lives. But I think only 40% of the people, or maybe even less now, I don't know what the latest numbers are, think it'll personally affect them. And so without that personal risk, right, it's like, it's not my problem. I don't have to deal with it. So I think that's just an intriguing parallel and creates the, you know, the challenge of COVID is the same sort of communication challenge of climate change. In a sense.
I
wanted to make was, you know, what we talked about values, and Gail, you posed the question about, you know, what do we have to do? And Bruce, you mentioned, you know, is there a civil war in our future? And which is a serious concern that I think that we have to focus on. But I think what we have is, instead of a significant departure on values, I think we've introduced demonization into the vernacular, and then disinformation also then perpetuates the demonization. And a lot of activist groups are seeing disinformation as the primary threat to being able to really have a clear conversation about values, because really the underlying values that we all have, I mean, there's human values, right, that we know that everybody has. But if we are unable to articulate them in a way that people see opportunity and advancement and benefit, and the fact that together those values can create that future, if we're unable to do that in a disinformation and a media environment that doesn't allow it, then I think we're going to be stuck. And it's just intriguing to me that while Fox News is now, you know, the no longer preferred media outlet for conservatives since they called the election, I guess, for Biden in Arizona, people are flocking to other, you know, One America and Newsmax, which are more conservative. So it's intriguing. There's an appetite for the disinformation that's out there. So it's a very systemic challenge, I think, and I'm not quite sure how to muddle through it, but those are pieces I see.
Well, let me suggest, if I can jump in, is demonization is nothing new in the United States. I mean, the demonization of Black people with Jim Crow, you know, the fact that hundreds of Black people were lynched every year for a generation, and it took, you know, the civil rights movement to change that in the United States, the second American Revolution, if you will, or the second American Civil War, a lot of people talk about. I mean, it's nothing new in the United States, but it's a different sort of target audience this time. Truman, I jumped in on you.
Yeah, that's okay. I appreciate that because it's more relevant to what what I was going to say, you're talking about climate change. And one of the things that just drives me crazy, I think One of the problems is that the deniers are not necessarily denying that the climate is changing, but they're denying the government taking control of their lives or their livelihood or whatever, forcing them to do something about it. I think that's really their concern. And so I would like to propose a little different approach to it. And that is to say, look, we know this is happening. We don't know if it's our fault. You know, maybe it is, maybe it is. But at least let's plan for it. And let's plan to do something to mitigate the results of it. And maybe if we come at it from that standpoint, we can get more people on board and then eventually move toward how do we try to mitigate the issue. But it's just a little bit different way of looking at it, but one that can help get more folks on board.
I like that kind of thinking, Truman. In fact, that's what I used a lot doing therapy with people. If people were on the fence about something, we'd say, let's just make this a demo. Let's see what happens if you try it for a month. Mm-hmm. You know, something mm-hmm. like that may be more palatable. But I wanted to add something to what you said. Is I've talked about this quite a bit, is the commonweal versus the individualism that we have kind of gone down, you know, full force in America with being very individualistic, and it's all about our rights as opposed to our responsibilities in this country. I actually got very nerdy and started reading one of the political philosophers, Thomas Hobbes, about this, who was one of the few earliest men, I guess this was in the 1700s, who talked about the commonweal. And I kind of wanted to hear how he defined that. And he just kind of said, well, any group, you know, that gets together pretty much consciously or unconsciously decides how you feed and shelter that group and how you provide for a common defense. And he added, and promote the peace for that group. That the commonweal just means, you know, when more than one people are gathered together, you can't just all be individualistic and have a very well-functioning team that protects each other. You know, in America, we immediately go down the counter to that, which, oh, no, that's socialism, which is the political state that might result from thinking about, you know, what does the commonwealth need? But I would just add, I think we need a better balance between the individuals who are all about me, and take a little bit more of a family approach to how do we take care of everybody in our family in a way that still works with capitalism. I just don't think the individual is the be all and the end all.
If I can jump in, Michael, just there's a fascinating book called Fairness and Freedom, comparing New Zealand and the United States by one of my favorite authors, a political scientist, David Hackett. And he looks at that very question, Lynn, and he says, basically, in New Zealand, fairness dominates, you know, sort of equity in society because of the time New Zealand was founded. New Zealand was founded at a time in the early 19th century, the early 1800s, when Britain was going through the Industrial Revolution and equity and sort of social justice were dominant concerns. America was settled 100, 150 years earlier when religious wars were racking England, and the English settlers that came here were more concerned about my individual freedom of religion. And so what you get are two democratic societies, one in which the individual becomes sort of elevated to the pinnacle of that's the ultimate freedom, what to do whatever I want to do, versus New Zealand, where the freedom is to do what's best for society. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating read. Michael, I jumped in on top of you there.
No, that's thank fine. You. Thank you, Bruce. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's that sounds like a really good book. Fairness and Freedom. Is that the name of the
Fairness and Freedom.
Fairness mm-hmm. and Freedom. I'll have to look that up. I don't know, when I was thinking about the dissolution of the country, and that's occurred to me at different times before. I thought, you know, what do I have in common with somebody living in Tuscaloosa or something? I almost nothing in terms of how I view the world. of course, there's my U.S. citizenship, and I feel that kind of solidarity with the person. But it's interesting what you said there, Bruce. It seems almost as if the country coming together in that way, it almost guarantees a real friction point between, okay, we're going to work together here, you know, out of many one, but by golly, I want to do things the way I want to do them in my neck of the woods. And that's, Gail, the first thing that came to me when you talked about, you know, if it broke up and we had Cascadia or something. And it's fine, you know, I've thought of that. It's okay, Washington, Oregon, you know, Northern California. And then I thought, well, east of the mountains, as you get north of Seattle or south of Tacoma and Olympia, it's a very different state. It's more like Puget Sound region. And the rest of the state is pretty darn red. Mm-hmm. And the same thing as you go down the Oregon coast. There's a kind of a built-in friction there.
Yeah. It's interesting, Michael, you're bringing up that sort of what I see as the point behind you. You're what you're talking about is are there more things that divide us than there are things that pull us together as American citizens? And one of the things that's always sort of fascinates me is when you travel around the world, there's never a problem of people identifying other people from other countries of identifying who's an American tourist. You know, Americans are different from the rest of the world. And so as different as we are within America, it's easy for other people in the world to identify an American, no matter who they are, no matter what color, no matter what socioeconomic status, no matter what, Americans stand out. And so there may be more things that pull us together as Americans and define us as Americans than there are things that pull us apart. Truman.
Yeah, I was to comment on that. I spent 18 months in Germany when I was in the military and spent quite a bit of time on the economy. I had a bunch of German friends and learned, you know, I mean, I learned to blend in with their groups and all. And a buddy of mine who was down in Stuttgart, he was in the same boat. And when we got out, we stayed in Europe. We took a European out. Mm-hmm. And I got a note from a guy, long story who this guy is, but anyway, an American who had just graduated from college, and he was going to come to Europe to tour Europe. And he said, hey, can I travel with you guys? And my buddy and I said, well, yeah, why not? You know, it's okay. And he was the classic American. And he, the two of us, you know, we'd kind of acclimated to Europe, and we couldn't stand the guy. You know, it was like, God, you're driving us nuts, man. Because he stood out, you know, as an American, and we did not, because we learned how to, you know, to defend. But anyway, I find that really interesting, Bruce. You're right. We are very different from others.
Bruce, could you tell us more specifically, or any of the brief fleas, what makes an American stand out to others? I know that Rick Steveland said, I think it was Rick Steveland, like, don't wear white tennis shoes everywhere. Yeah, yeah. But beyond that, I'm curious if there's a deeper.
No, it's more than that, believe me.
Lynn, I'll tell you one. This is Lynn. I will never forget this. I was in Tulum, Mexico, looking at the ruins in Tulum, and they had a bunch of outside, you know, food hawker stalls, and I got what turned out to be a very deadly chicken enchilada for myself. It ruined my trip. But what I noticed standing in there was a woman, very overweight, in pink velour hot pants, pushing to the front of the line, talking super loud about, you know, did they have this and did they have that and what she wanted. And, you know, there are all these people she just completely broke in front of, wearing, in this Catholic country, these unbelievably embarrassing hot pants. I just wanted to die right on the spot.
I became Canadian a few times. I can
admit. Yes, me too.
All right. Easy escape. I'm from Canada. Okay? Yeah. Michael.
There's something that's occurred to me too, Lynn. You talked about the common wheel, and that, I think that's a wonderful concept. Again, very so fortunate to live on Vashon Island, where there are groups like the Land Trust
absolutely
dozens of others who are helping to preserve areas where anyone can go and wander about. It's remarkable. But I also thought the common wheel is defined by someone over in Ferry County, over east of the mountains there, or Okanagan County, where my brother-in-law and sister live. That their idea of the common wheel is very different from ours over here in the central Puget Sound region. And I think that's where, although we might all be Washingtonians and American citizens, I think that's where a lot of the conflict comes in. Those folks have their notion of what the common wheel is, and they feel extraordinarily put upon by essentially King County. King County is it's like the 2,000-pound gorilla of the state. What King County decrees goes for the rest of the state. And that's a tough pill for people to swallow, because their lives are so different over there.
Michael, how would you say they define it?
The common wheel?
Yeah.
I think talking to my sister and brother-in-law and having traveled there some, there's a much greater sense of our town, our little village center, because there's a lot of small towns over there. Like, drive through them and blink and you've missed them. But they do things the way that they want. They want to be able to be involved in their schools the way that they want. They want to be able to maybe set the curriculum for the schools more according to their tastes. Little things like that. I think there's a strong sense of leave us alone. We'll manage our own lives. We don't need to be told what's right or wrong or moral or immoral by somebody living far away.
That's a good transition to my next kind of question. We've only got a couple minutes left here. That sort of leave us alone, let us do it our way. We see a new vaccine being rolled out. It looks like it's going to be fairly effective. It looks like it's going to be available, sometime mid next year at the latest, maybe before, depending on how allocations go and how the supply chain holds up, all that sort of stuff. But are you going to take the vaccine when it's available? And I'd like to sort of hear from the Brieflys. Let's just sort of go around. We'll start with Gail and end up with Truman. Sort of going around my screen. So, Gail, are you going to have a vaccine shot?
Yeah, I certainly would, both to protect myself as well as others. I would take the vaccine. I do think it's a fascinating conversation about who is going to be offered the vaccine. And I think that's worthy of some real deep diving, but sure. that's my short answer.
Yeah. Lynn.
I will take it. And I agree, Gail, I would like to see the essential workers get the vaccine ahead of, let us call me a younger elder. I've heard today the 80-year-olds may start getting it with the round of people being in nursing homes. You know, the most vulnerable people are gonna get it after the healthcare providers. They're going to do a mass inoculation starting now. And I would like to be in line after personally the essential workers who have to go to work every day.
Michael.
Yeah, I'll be happy to take it and happy to wait my turn. I I'm very grateful that I've been able to stay as isolated as I have and as careful as I've been. So I feel like there's a whole lot of other people before me that need it much more than I do.
Kevin.
yes, I will. partly because, excuse me, and I don't think I need to see Dr. Fauci get the shot first. I think what's happened is that the evidence that the CDC, the process, although many attempts to politicize it have been made, I think that that institution is holding firm. And the new administration coming on board, I think, is just going to add stability to that process. I do say after you take the shot, we're being warned to still mask up, because even though we may not get sick from the virus, we still might shed the virus, even if we've had the vaccine. So something to be aware of.
Yeah, my answer is absolutely yes. And I think the essential workers and not the 80-year-olds in the nursing home. And the only reason for that is, why waste it on folks who are not going to be with us that much longer anyway? Sorry to be so blunt, but that, yeah. But I really think that's the case. Hey, we are out of time, folks. We got to go right now. So see you all next week.
Thanks, Truman.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Stay well, everybody.